KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, why writers on the E! Channel show Fashion Police went on strike, and why the show's host, Joan Rivers, could be in trouble with the Writers Guild. But first on the Hollywood News Banter, the ripple effects of Disney's Lone Ranger flop. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I am joined by my faithful banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, the Lone Ranger looks to be a very significant money loser, at least 150 million analysts think, as much as 190 million, according to one of the analysts. And the finger pointing has certainly begun, and this looks very much like a question of who is responsible? Is it the studio, Disney? Is it the producer, Jerry Bruckheimer? Is it the director, Gore Verbinski? You could even say, is it Johnny Depp pushing it too far with the bird on his head?
Yeah, it's like the old Hollywood adage, success has many fathers and failures an orphan. And I think some people we have to include are looking at Rich Ross, the former Disney studio chief who was around when this movie started and certainly was blamed for John Carter and other Disney fiascos. I don't know. I mean, the one person who certainly isn't taking any blame is Bob Iger, who runs Disney. Gore Verbinski, the director, probably is going to have a little comeback work to do. And yet producer Jerry Bruckheimer, whose last couple of movies outside of Pirates of the Caribbean have also not succeeded. Sorcerer's Apprentice, Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, G-Force. Again, I think Jerry Bruckheimer, for all the support he has in town, has to prove that he still has it, especially when it comes to big budget movies like this.
Yeah, he's certainly been hugely successful in film and TV. I mean, he's had a 30-year plus career, huge franchises. He's on the Pirates of the Caribbean films alone have generated over $3 billion for Disney in box office, just in box office. So, you know, it's a staggering, storied career. And I think a lot of sort of old Hollywood is protective of him. But, you know, the question is joined, is it the producer's job to control a director like Gore Verbinski, who is known for profligacy and who, you know, spends? I mean, this was a combination of shooting on location and dealing with things like weather that are impossible to control, and a director who takes the bit in his teeth and will have his way. And we've seen these big deal directors. You know, Jim Cameron is the same. The Titanic was an exercise in exactly this kind of struggle, but it worked out well.
Yeah, I talked to a producer who's had his share of hits and misses, and he said the thing that was so surprising to him is when you start a franchise or try to start a franchise, generally you start a little bit more modestly. You don't spend $250 million for the first installment. Maybe you do that if you get to a third film, that you try to make your first movie for around $100, $120 million. I mean, it doesn't work. The losses aren't as bad. The problem with Lone Ranger, it was Disney put all its chips on the table and they lost the hand.
Yeah, they fought very hard to contain the budget. Bob Iger himself did make this deal. And so in the aftermath, I think the relationship with Jerry Bruckheimer is honestly toast. Bruckheimer's longstanding deal with Disney, more than 20 years, is up in spring 2014. There is still another Pirates of the Caribbean plan. That will probably go forward. Disney's certainly planning on it. But I think beyond that, Jerry Bruckheimer will have ended a very long career with Disney. Meanwhile, you know, as the broadcast networks, they're still doing a lot of business in the upfronts, which, you know, is the aftermath that they presented their fall schedules in May to advertisers in New York. And the sales that they had hoped for are not coming in. Still a lot of money, but not as much as they wanted.
No, there was a projection that it would be an increase over last year's. And the upfronts are kind of a rolling event that starts in May and kind of goes through the early parts of the summer. Last year was between $8.8 and $9.3 billion. And this year, it looks like it's going to be down to $8.5 billion at the low end and $9 billion at the high end. Now, still a ton of money, but certainly a decrease. And the other thing that I think is really surprising is that cable, where a lot of advertising money has been going and a lot of viewers have been going, the increase is just going to be single low digits, maybe 1% or 2% from a year ago.
Yeah, so it's tough in the TV business. Obviously tougher for anybody who's not CBS, meaning NBC, ABC, Fox, all of which have had some rebuilding to do with their schedules. So as the fall comes in, we'll see if some of these shows are hits and the networks can start jacking up those prices again.
Yeah, and it's not just that they're not spending money on TV. They're spending more money on digital. So it's not just that the advertisers are holding back. They're just allocating their money in a very different way. It's kind of like the newspaper business. A lot of those advertisements are going to digital, and the TV business is starting to suffer the same kinds of problems.
Speaking of problems, Rupert Murdoch, you know, they split his company into an entertainment company and a publishing company, you know, with Fox and Fox News and the Fox Network and all of that under one roof, and the Wall Street Journal and his various newspapers and on under another roof. It seemed like, you know, things were sort of moving forward. And then this tape has surfaced in Britain of Rupert Murdoch talking to the staff of one of his newspapers, The Sun, and seeming to acknowledge that he was aware of bribery of police. And now Parliament is getting back into the game.
Yes, Murdoch had testified in front of Parliament that he had no knowledge of voicemail interception or police bribery, part of the Parliament investigation into phone hacking. And yet when he went to The Sun and was secretly recorded speaking to the staff, he talked about the culture of Fleet Street, where these newspapers are based. And he said the whole idea of police bribery was, quote, the culture of Fleet Street. So on the one hand, he says one thing to Parliament. On the other hand, he seems to be contradicting himself. And I think it opens himself up to charges of perjury.
And certainly there's a question of a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act here in the United States, because if there's an awareness that an official of a company has bribed an official in a foreign country, that can create a huge legal headaches here. And I think those investigations or inquiries have already been begun to some degree in Washington and seem to be very quiet, but who knows now? We should add that the company has denied that Murdoch really knew of any wrongdoing and is sticking to the story that it had initially told.
Yeah, but it's not going to go away, as you said, anytime soon.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. And you can keep up with us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John's is at JG Horn. And our producer, Darby Maloney, is at Darby KCRW. Coming up later in the show, in an escalating labor fight, the Writers Guild weighs whether lifetime member Joan Rivers violated union rules. But first, we hear from striking writers on her show, Fashion Police. In April, 9 of the 12 writers working on the E! Channel show, Fashion Police, went on strike. They were protesting a lack of standard labor benefits, such as a health and pension plan and overtime pay. This past week, they released a video beseeching Joan Rivers, who co-hosts the show, to support them in their efforts to join the Writers Guild. The 80-year-old Rivers is a guild member herself.
When you're first approached, do you want to write for a legend, you know, like Joan Rivers? You're thrilled.
When I first started, it was amazing writing for Joan Rivers. You know, the first thing I did was call my parents and say, Joan Rivers is saying my words.
When I was a kid, at first, I never thought that women couldn't be comedians because there was always Joan Rivers. One of the biggest names in comedy was a woman's name.
It is an honor to work for Joan. It is without a doubt an honor to work for Joan.
When I started on Fashion Police, my relationship with Joan was, it could not have been better. We really hit it off immediately.
At a glance, it may not be obvious that there are writers on Fashion Police, which involves Rivers and co-hosts Kelly Osbourne, Juliana Rancic, and George Katsiopoulos joking about photos of celebrities in various states of dress.
The dress is very pretty. I love the liquid fabric, all that lovely, 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 but the makeup, the stupid eyes. I looked at this picture and I thought, they dug up Whitney Houston. It is just
too soon, still.
The eyes are smokier than Courtney Love's lungs.
However spontaneous all that seems, writers come up with material for Fashion Police. While the Writers Guild has been trying to establish jurisdiction over unscripted programming for some time, the union says this program is a no-brainer. Fashion Police is a comedy variety show and falls squarely under its jurisdiction. The E! Network issued a statement saying that Joan Rivers is emphatically supportive of the writers, but her company doesn't produce Fashion Police and doesn't set compensation for the writers. He also said the network is open to letting the writers vote on the union issue if that election is overseen by the federal government's National Labor Relations Board. But the Writers Guild says that's not required, and the company is stonewalling. To learn more about what led the Fashion Police staff to strike, the business producer Darby Maloney sat down with writers Eliza Skinner and Jackie Beat. They say that work on Fashion Police originally was supposed to be part-time, but it didn't work out that way.
You know, it starts out very flexible and, oh, maybe this doesn't take quite as much time. And then it just got, like, they just kept asking for more and more and more. And then occasionally we'd sit down at the table and they'd be talking about how the show is, like, just through the roof and, like, the number one show. And, you know, and now the Oscar special is 90 minutes. The show's going from half an hour to an hour on a regular basis. I mean, obviously, that's a lot more work. That's double the material.
Yeah. But to lay out the basics of the job, it was that we would get that packet of about 20 photos.
What were the photos of?
Of celebrities, which are the same photos that they show on the show. We had a quota of 8 to 10 jokes per photo, which would come out to be about 200 jokes per episode.
And some of them were games where you'd do a before and after.
Right.
There'd be a reveal. So that would be even more jokes.
Mm-hmm. That would take, you know, 35 hours or so to write all of those jokes, give or take. And then we would go to their house in Malibu, pitch them to Joan and the producers. She would select some that she liked. That wouldn't happen at the table. We would just go home after that and get an email saying, okay, these are the photos that we still want more jokes on. So we'd write those, send them in by 3 a.m., mm-hmm. and then they would tape the show the next morning. So it was a lot of compressed work. We would usually be up until like 2 in the morning writing and then wake up at 4 and keep writing.
It used to be that if you couldn't make it to one of the pitch meetings, which ran 3 or 4 hours.
At least 4 hours. Sometimes
at Melissa's house.
Joan Rivers' daughter, Melissa.
If you couldn't physically make it, you could, you know, just turn them in via email. And then it got to the point where it was mandatory to be there.
And how many months in the year is it? Is it all
year round?
So it's year round. Year round.
Okay. And I was hired right before award season, which is particularly brutal because we would meet at E around 2:30, 3 o'clock for the pre-show to just sit in, you know.
We were told we needed to be there, too.
Yeah, yeah. And now they're, you know, they claim that was voluntary and not mandatory. But anyway, you'd sit in a room watching, you know, the Oscars and then work until 6 or 7 in the morning and they claim that, you know, that's not overtime. We work 8 hours a week on this show.
Yeah, when we did those, no matter what the show, no matter how much we had done, including those specials, our paychecks said hours worked, 8. And when we did those specials, we would show up at E, give them our ID so that we could get a pass to use the elevators, and then get that, and they would log it in, and then we would get that ID back 17 hours later. And they'd log that. And then we would still get a paycheck that said 8 hours worked.
Okay, so basically the job ended up taking way more time than you expected, something like a full-time job, not in the way that, you know, other industries have a 9-to-5 job. It's such a non-linear job,
yeah, exactly.
So that there's opportunity for holes and whatever. But you guys, at least 9 of you, got together and said, this is full-time. We believe we deserve the benefits that come with a full-time job that is a unionized, Writers Guild-sanctioned job.
And another thing is that people don't realize is it's not just benefits that unfortunately these days seem like gravy to most people. Like, you know, oh, you should just be lucky to have a job. We're talking about, like, some people were being paid $610 for all of this work. Most people were being paid $500, or the new people at least. And you could be fired at any time. If they were done with you, you'd just get an email or a text, you know, not working out, thanks a lot. And it's like you've passed up other jobs. You know, you always had to set that time aside.
We did initially think, well, maybe they just don't know how much work it takes. Initially, we thought, I think each one of us thought, oh, it takes much longer for me personally. And then we started talking to each other and realized, oh, it takes this much time for everybody who does this. And then we thought, well, okay, if we just tell them that what they're asking for is actually a huge amount of work, then they'll understand and they'll want to adjust things.
When you say they, who's the they?
Joan is mostly the they.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Our producer, Darby Maloney, is talking with two of the Fashion Police writers who have been on strike since April, Eliza Skinner and Jackie Beat. Joining them in the studio here at KCRW was Neil Sakharo from the Writers Guild of America West, which is backing the writers' efforts to organize. A spokesperson for E!, which produces and airs the show, maintains that it's not opposed to the union and notes that the guild already represents the staff of two E! Shows, Chelsea Lately, hosted by Chelsea Handler, and The Soup, hosted by Joel McHale.
In the case of Chelsea and The Soup, I think one of the big things, and here's a good indication of why these folks have such an issue with Joan, is that Chelsea and Joel were extremely supportive and vocal in their support of their writers and their desire to be covered by the Guild. That changes the dynamic. When you have a host who is vocally supporting, you know, the writers, the management and the producers listen.
Okay, so Jackie, you mentioned some dollar amounts that a lot of people who are writing on Fashion Police get paid $500 a week, some get $610 a week. What would your compensation look like if it was a guild?
I can answer that.
Okay, Neil.
For a guild show in this, you know, in the comedy variety genre, and these contracts go for 13-week periods, it would range probably somewhere between $3,500 and $3,800 a week.
That's a really big difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you got to realize, I know it sounds like, wow, that's a huge amount, but these shows make a lot of money. This is not about like you're trying to get this. And the reason these salaries have been negotiated is that the industry, this is what's accepted. This is what the industry can pay. They make a lot of money from advertisers.
When I first heard the difference and did the math for the entire crew of writers and realized how much more they would have to pay per episode, I was like, well, this is just impossible. There's no way because, I mean, it's more money than I have probably made in a year. But then I realized, like, oh, that's one commercial break. They make that money. They show this show so many times, and they sell so many commercials for it. It's not as huge a deal to them as it would be, as meaningful a deal as it would be to all of us.
Is that part of their argument, is saying that that's an unsustainable number for our budget?
They're not even bothering to argue with us.
Joan's main concern was that I have 12 writers, and if we go guild, there's no way I can have 12 writers churning out these jokes, and I'll have to fire some people, and who am I going to fire? That's an impossible decision. But the fact that they're doing the I don't think that you need 12 writers, first of all.
I mean, if Joan says that she needs 12 writers, then Joan needs 12 writers. And no one, it didn't result in people getting fired off of the other shows that have comparable numbers of writers. And at this point, I mean, even if it meant that I got, I don't want to sound like disgustingly noble, even if I got fired and this show got union contracts for 11 writers, I would feel much more comfortable with it. It just feels dirty to do all of this work and get, like, pocket change.
By the way, can you guys, Jackie and Eliza, can you take a full-time job on another show now?
Mm-hmm.
So if you get hired on a full-time show that would eclipse your ability to go back to work on Fashion Police, should a resolution come about, you're not precluded from doing that.
No, the guild has encouraged us to be employed and not have to personally suffer too much. And when and if that happens, then we have to make the decision. Where do we work?
Eliza Skinner and Jackie Beat are writers. They have been writing on Fashion Police, but are currently on strike. Neil Sakharo is the director of communications for the Writers Guild West. Thank you guys so much for coming in and giving us an explanation on what's been going on.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
After a short break, the Writers Guild charges Joan Rivers, a lifetime member, with violating union rules. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. If you like our podcast, you will probably also like KCRW's The Treatment with host Elvis Mitchell. Go to iTunes and search KCRW.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We've been talking about the writer's strike on the E! Network show Fashion Police. 9 of 12 writers on that show argue that their work should fall under the jurisdiction of the Writers Guild. The union agrees and has ordered members not to work on the show, which continues to air. To press its case, the Guild and the striking writers are putting the focus on Joan Rivers, the primary host of the show and a lifetime Guild member. This past week, the Writers Guild East, based in New York, said it would ask a 3-member panel to consider whether Rivers has violated union rules by writing for the show despite the Guild's no-work order. The consequences could be a fine or expulsion. Rivers' personal manager, Larry Thompson, has issued a statement saying the comedian has not been notified of the Guild's action. He adds that this is an issue between E and the Writers Guild and that Rivers is simply on-air talent. To better understand the charges that the Guild is considering against Rivers, the business producer, Darby Maloney, spoke with Lowell Peterson, the WGA East's executive director, from his office in New York.
What is the Writers Guild of America East charging Joan Rivers with having done?
We have an internal disciplinary procedure in which members can charge other members with violating the union's rules. So that's what happened in this case. Two of our members, they filed charges against Joan Rivers, which are now being referred ultimately to a trial board, which will consist of 3 members who will hear, presumably from Joan and from the writers and whatever evidence, other evidence they think is relevant. But the charges are that she wrote and did show running on The Fashion Police, which is a non-covered show, and then continued to do that even after a strike was called at the show.
The charges that are brought against Joan are brought by a couple of members of the Guild.
Yes.
But not necessarily people who were writers on Fashion Police.
Yeah, that's correct. And that's permitted by the Constitution and bylaws. They're not direct witnesses or you know, suffered direct harm. I mean, Joan is a member of the East, which is why we're doing it here in the East. I'm sure that the most relevant evidence is going to come from members in the West, because they're the ones who know exactly what happened. So in that sense, it's a little unusual.
And again, you're the executive director, so you have no oversight over this.
Right, just to make sure the process runs smoothly. Mm-hmm.
Is there precedent for this?
Well, we haven't had anything in the East for as long as anybody who's on staff here remembers. I mean, it's pretty unusual. The internal union discipline isn't uncommon in the labor movement generally. So there's precedent in that sense, but we haven't had to discipline members. I think it's, you know, the trial board members are going to hear the evidence and decide whether what Joan did violated the rules. I mean, she's accused of writing and show running on a non-Guild show, and, you know, there's a strike on. If that's proven true, I would assume the trial board would say, gee, Joan, that's a violation of our working rules. You can't do that. But I can't prejudge it. That's going to be a decision made by those members.
Now, when you have a trial, it's this 3-person trial board. Who is on that?
Well, they'll be members who will be appointed by our council. That's what we call our board. It's the elected officers.
Okay.
So it'll be 3 members selected by the council.
And we're using the word trial, but are lawyers part of this process?
They are not. They are not part of this process. It's pretty clear that it's intended to be member-driven. She can be represented by another member under our bylaws, nor can the charging parties bring counsel. The only lawyer present is the Guild's own attorney will be there to provide procedural advice.
And when will the trial happen?
That will be determined by the trial board. We don't yet have a full complement of trial board members. Once that's done, the charges will be formally sent out. She's received them a while ago, but then the trial board will convene a trial. I assume people will try to accommodate one another's schedules, but it will be soon. It should be a matter of weeks, not months.
Have you heard from Joan?
No. She got the charges some weeks ago. Haven't heard anything from her.
Now, you have a background with other other labor organizations outside of the entertainment business. Is that right?
Yes, both inside and outside. Mm-hmm.
How would you place in context what this particular story around the fashion police writers, how does that reflect or not reflect a trend that's happened in the entertainment business, and does it have any corollary outside of it?
You know, organizing is something that all unions need to do. And I would say the way that this one is particular to the entertainment industry is that E! Channel and its parents and the people who work in this case, Los Angeles, in this business, have a pretty long tradition of signing shows like this. It's surprising that there's been such resistance on the part of management, if you will, to signing the Guild contract. You know, it's a talk show. There are a lot of talk shows in the West and in the East, both, that are signatory to the main Guild agreement. If there's a trend, I'm not sure there is, but the trend is, well, why is this employer not doing what has been traditional, which is you sign the contract? If there are budget issues, there are provisions in the contract for addressing those. So it's a little puzzling. I mean, the underlying dispute is about why the writers are not getting covered by a Guild contract. Why are they not getting pension and health benefits? Why are they not getting compensation that's in line with what the industry pays? I'm not sure why. I'm not involved in that campaign. I've read about the wage violation complaints. It seems a little puzzling that a network of the scope of E and its corporate parents are being so resistant here. I don't get it. It's a popular show. People like it. It's got good ratings. I assume they sell a lot of ads. Not sure why the company is drawing the line in the sand like this. I just don't know. I mean, in terms of the actual discipline, it's most of the time union members have, you know, solidarity. What Joan is accused of doing is unusual. It would be unusual for someone with a long career to not support their fellow writers. But again, the trial board will hear the evidence on what she did or didn't do.
But how is what she is doing different from, say, what David Letterman did or Jon Stewart or any of the other hosts of talk shows that kept their shows on the air during the last writer's strike but without their writers?
Well, it's actually quite different in that they didn't write for themselves or for others, and they didn't do show running duties. Well, Letterman, there was a contract that was reached with Letterman, so he actually was working under a Guild agreement. The Comedy Central shows by most accounts, the fact the writers were not there sort of showed. They were kind of improvised shows without our members writing. Those guys didn't even write for themselves or do any of the kinds of things that Joan is accused of doing. So it's different. I mean, I know it sounds similar, but in fact, it's different. And what Joan is accused of doing is writing for herself and show running. And that is an important distinction.
All right. Thank you so much.
Sure.
That's Lowell Peterson, Executive Director of the Writers Guild East.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps, and you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.